The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
Okay. Alcock's question about male red-winged blackbird behavior. He says that you observe male red-winged blackbirds that are interfering with the foraging activity of mates that have engaged in extra-pair copulations with neighboring territorial males. And we propose that the behavior is adaptive because it enables males to reduce their investment in offspring likely to carry another male's genes. Why would it reduce their investment? How's that helping them? Can you guess about how these birds are behaving? If he's interfering with their foraging activity, basically, you see, doesn't want her to go out foraging because that's when she's most likely to encounter other males. Is it adaptive? Well, not for her. But that, remember, there's often conflict between the sexes. And this kind of thing. So it's adaptive for the male if it will reduce the likelihood that his mate would be laying eggs that were fertilized by another male. And then he would be raising children that are not his, birds that are not his. So how could you test that? What does it mean to test the hypothesis using the comparative method? Remember? Because we talked about this before. Yes, Ty?
Looking at a similar species, and then to see if the male is not interfering, one of the children will have a larger chance of not being killed.
Yeah, there'd be a couple things. One is you look at species faced with a similar problem with females that when they go out foraging, likely to mate with another male, and red-winged blackbirds do that. Even birds that we thought were monogamous, it's been found that they do this pretty commonly. So if you have birds faced with similar issues, then you'd like to see if the male is doing the same thing. Has the same thing evolved more than once? There should be some convergent evolution if it's adaptive. To test whether it's adaptive or not, you'd have to have some way to prevent. One way would be to prevent him from doing that. Don't let him attack the female. And don't let him prevent her from foraging. Or just look at get genetic material from the offspring and then find out when you do that with birds where he's not interfered as much and where he's interfered more, see if it actually makes a difference in how often he's rearing young that aren't his. You'd have to test the idea. So there's two things. One is to test. That's an experiment. It's not the comparative method. To test with a comparative method, you're simply looking at similar situations with other species. Did any of you read this question? Question two there. This is the next chapter, which I just assigned along with chapter 4. Suppose someone said to you that given a choice between a cultural explanation for human behavior and a sociobiological one, you ought to give precedence to the cultural explanation because our behavior is so obviously shaped by the culture in which we live. So how do you respond if you're a sociobiologist or if you're anybody. And you know something about sociology. Would you always prefer the cultural explanation? I mean, my initial response is, what is this really an either-or situation? You know? Does it have to be one explanation or the other? Because it's a situation where both might be true. You know? I'd also look at the motivation of people that prefer the cultural explanations, because many of these people don't believe in any inheritance of behavior, as you know. They think everything is shaped by learning and that we have free choice. Sociobiologists doesn't argue with free choice. It's just that our choices are influenced by our what? By our feelings. And those feelings are coming from someplace. And they come because our brain is put together in a certain way. And the way that certain way is put together is genetically determined, right? And that's the way instincts are usually expressed in terms of motivation, the motivational component anyway. And often there are specific action patterns in addition associated with it. Which again, we have some learning component as well as innate component. This was an interesting one, the other question that I wanted you to consider. He points out that the earlier studies of extrapair copulations in birds were focused only on male birds. And it was only later that there was more attention given to the female birds. And was that early focus just because the people doing the studies were male? Is this evidence for gender bias? Well, I would say that there's actually pretty good evidence that there are gender differences in human gender differences in the way field studies are done. The example, though, the primary example is not with birds, but with primate behavior, field studies of primates. Now, there weren't many studies before Jane Goodall and others, Diane Fossey, who studied gorillas, and Jane Goodall with the chimps, and then many, many people that follow them, their students and others. But there were some field studies earlier. And they didn't uncover a lot of the things that were uncovered by Jane and others. The fact is, statistically, there's at least informal evidence that women are better at understanding social behavior in primates than men are. And it's probably good evidence that they're better at understanding human social behavior as well. Their intuition is better. And that created the revolution in primate studies, field studies done by women working in the field who had a better understanding of what was going on among these primates. But what about the birds? I mean, there were definitely prejudices about extrapair copulations in humans, but that may not be the reason why there was so much focus on the males. The fact is, it does occur more with males than with females. But it may, and you have to start somewhere, you know, and before they became so common, you'd have to look at the studies and find out how long and how many studies were done only on males before any attention was given to the females, and also what these people were saying in their papers. It would take a bet to prove that it was really gender bias. and when the study started to be done on the female birds, it was not done only by female investigators. It was done by male also. All right. So let's get going now on the main topic of the day, some of these discoveries of sociobiology. First of all, and this is an important question, about the big change that happened in animal behavior research, roughly around 1970. What was that change? First of all, before 1970, there were behavior studies of animals being done in both the U.S. and in Europe, but on the two continents, the studies were very different. In Europe, they were dominated by zoology and zoologists, and prominent among them was Conrad Lorenz. In Germany, Nico Tinbergen. In England, Carl von Frisch in Germany, studying bees and other insects. Gino Tinbergen studied insects as well, like his studies of wasps that we read. So they dominated that earlier work in Europe. And in America, the field animal behavior studies were, it was called comparative psychology. And it was not so much studies of natural behavior. Most of the studies were done on laboratory animals, rats, cats, monkeys, a few on mice and hamsters. In Russia, they were being done with dogs primarily. But they were experimental studies, not field studies, and they were designed to test hypotheses about human brain and behavior. Okay. Like the many studies of learning, most of them done on rats, were designed to test ideas about theories of learning. It was a totally different emphasis, and it was done without much regard for natural behavior of animals. And you still find the dominance of that tradition in America. You will find, even in this building, people studying monkey learning, where it takes the monkey thousands of trials to learn something. Are they studying anything natural? No. Is it relevant to the animal? Not much, in my opinion. Might not even be too relevant to human. I think it's a mistake when you don't study things that the animal is adapted to do. And many rodent studies are done the same way. They've gotten a little better. Things like the water maze, for example, is a fairly natural behavior. The animals can learn it quite rapidly, which is a good indication that it's something animals do. Or at least it's related to something we do normally. But we always run the danger when we do controlled experiments that will make it so unnatural for the animal that our results may become fairly irrelevant to anything that would explain the animal's natural behavior. But what was, if you just look in animal behavior literature, okay, what was the big change? It should be obvious to you by now from the talks and the readings. Yeah.
Oh, from looking at proximate causes to.
Yeah, that was the big shift. There were still studies of proximate causes, but it was the shift in concern about adaptation, evolution of the behavior, ultimate questions about the behavior. And many of those questions weren't even asked, weren't being asked. When people talked about evolution of behavior before I should say about 1966, George Williams' paper. That was a big turning point. Sociobiology book brought together a lot of those papers, and it was 1975. But if you just compare papers around 1970 with papers being published in the 90s, you see statistically this big shift in numbers of papers concerned with the more what we now are calling ultimate questions rather than proximate questions. But we still have both kinds of research, and there were a few on ultimate questions. But when people talked about evolution, when they were doing ethology, for example, they were more interested in the history. How is this particular action similar or different from a closely related animal? And can we trace the similarities to a common ancestor and so forth? Obviously relevant to sociobiology, but it's not the primary thing that sociobiologists ask. It's about its adaptive function. Okay. Well, one of these people wrote, included a lot of things about evolution, or at least comments about evolution in his writings, was Conrad Lawrence. And the text here points out about his something about his 1966 book, On Aggression. The book I've been using is a later book. But even in that later book, you will still see a mistake from the standpoint of sociobiology that he makes. His view of Darwinian theory, and he attributes things to Darwin, which are not quite correct. He talks about evolution, things that are adaptive for the species. This behavior evolved because it helped preserve the species, or helped the species continue. That's not the logic of a sociobiologist, as you know. Why didn't this mistake impede Conrad Lawrence in his major studies? Because his major concern was with proximate causation, okay? The sensory causes, the description of the, I mean, an ethogram, many of his students and he tried to construct were detailed descriptions of individual behaviors, all kinds of reproductive behaviors, mating behaviors, and aggressive behaviors and foraging behaviors and caretaking behaviors and nesting behaviors and so forth. I hope one of you will remind me to bring you an ethogram. I want you to see what these people actually did, because that's something you miss when you read sociobiology studies. You don't learn too much about what the animal's actually doing. At least you don't learn the range of actions. And I have one on the hamster, which is incredible, the number of things. And these were things observed in one animal after another. All the hamsters were about the same. I mean, the number of behavior patterns that they inherit, it's probably true for humans too, is astonishing. And until you see one of these ethograms, you can't appreciate that. As you can imagine, those papers that present ethograms were also quite lengthy. And the journals that were published in them had to permit a lot more space than is allowable in most journals that I'm familiar with in neuroscience and even animal behavior over here. So he wasn't really impeded because he wasn't dealing with the same kind of question. And the same thing was true of Tinbergen and von Frisch, the other two people that were the champions of ethology. we read Tinbergen and Lawrence. We didn't read von Frisch, but I was going to bring that book too, just so you could see it. I didn't bring it today, but I can show you that. He also wrote a major book on communication in bees. Okay. So now let's go back to William D. Hamilton. We mentioned this before. He analyzed altruistic behavior in insects, the altruistic behavior of the sterile workers, which Darwin recognized himself as a Darwinian puzzle. How do you explain it? You work for the colony, you never reproduce at all if you're a sterile worker. So my question is, Darwin analyzed that behavior and Hamilton analyzed that behavior. What knowledge that had been unavailable to Darwin was Hamilton able to apply to the problem? Yeah, somebody else. You two are answering all the questions. Somebody else. Yeah,
knowledge on genes and genetic transmission?
Yeah, Darwin didn't know anything about genes. You know, he certainly knew about inheritance and so forth, but the mechanism, inheritance, he knew nothing about. Okay, so Hamilton had a big advantage. He also knew that the Hymenoptera, these social insects that he was analyzing, workers are haploid. What does that mean? They don't have two copies of every gene, one from the father, one from the mother. They have one copy. Okay? On the average, sisters share about 75% of their genes rather than 50%. Okay? That's on the average. And that helps explain a number of things about social insects, as we will see here. But first, let's talk about a mammal where you see similarities to social insects. This mammal is closest to social insects in the way it lives. The naked mole rat. Yes?
I'm sorry. On the question before, I don't quite understand, and I didn't understand in the Scotland thing either, why the sisters share 75% of their genetic material. Are they haploid also?
Because they get genes from the mother and from the father, okay? But how are they getting them now? If they contain only one set of genes. Can anybody deal with that? Yeah. She wants to know why, just because they're haploid, why are they more closely related to their sisters? Why do they share more genes? Exactly. They get everything from the father, half from the mother. The result is, on the average, 75% of the genes will be shared with their siblings, their sisters, in a way.
They're getting everything from the mother, or?
Well, the mother carries two sets, but they'll get one of those sets. So the question, so if they have a sister, she might have gotten, she'll get an average of
half
of
them from the father.
Right, but they're getting everything from the father. Now, because of the way sex is determined, the sisters will share only 25% of the genes with the male drones. But We'll come to that in a minute. This, let's go back to the naked mole rats, and then we'll go back to the social insects. The naked mole rats, first I'm saying, well, how are they similar to the Hymenoptera in a way that leads sociobiologists to predict altruistic behavior in the naked mole rat? It's an African rat that lives in underground tunnels. I have at least one book on this animal. There have been some detailed studies of them. But why would you predict altruistic behavior? They have non-breeding workers also. Okay? Workers that never breed, they're closely related to the breeders, not because they're haploid. They all have the same mother. Generally, the breeders are one female and a few males. Okay, and the few males might be closely related to each other already because there's quite a bit of inbreeding. Okay, so the sharing of genes is above what you would normally have, even if they do just share the same mother because of inbreeding. If the various fathers are closely related to each other, then it's not like you would have if the fathers were unrelated. So that means those non-breeding workers share a lot of genes with the other offspring of that female, the other offspring that they're helping to take care of, to defend, sometimes giving their lives in defense, since they will bodily block tunnel entrances to a predator and so forth, and sometimes die doing it. There was a 1976 study, that's about the time sociobiology book by Wilson had appeared, where a lot of his information, he had already done his work on ants and bees, and he'd coined the word. But Trivers and Hare predicted that in colonies of social insects, workers would care more for future queens than for future drones, the males. And they had a very specific reason for making that prediction. You should be able to guess by now what it must be, that they're caring more for the queens, that is the female young that they're rearing, future breeders, than they are for the males that will be future male breeders. Then they must share more genes with the females than the males. The queens that they're caring for are their siblings, okay? They share 75% of the genes, okay? But with the males, they share an average of only 25%. Okay, because again, the peculiar genetics of the Hymenoptera that we were talking about before. And it was knowing that then that led directly to the behavioral prediction. And you always have to ask, you know, it seems odd asking these questions, because we think that, well, there's no way these animals could know, you know. And yet they behave as if they know. And this isn't once in a while. At least on the average, this is the behavior you get. And there's a similar problem here. and studies the European wood ant. Why should it matter to wood ant workers whether their mother mates with one male or with several? Why would that make a difference? Well, if they all have the same father, it'll be like in the previous things that we mentioned, they'd share on the average 75% of the genes. But if the sisters are half-sisters, the average will drop to 25%, just like for the brothers in these haploid individuals. And the behavior of the animals, he does, I think, describe some actual studies there. Well, he points out some specific observations there of the fire ant that support that. The more interesting thing was what he said about the Trubbers and Hare studies, where they point out the drastic difference in the way they behave towards the future queens and future drones, where they have good statistics. Apparently, with regard to this study, when the extra males come in, they can literally be torn apart for the workers and attacked. And that solves the genetic problem. They will be dealing only with animals they share more genes with. The sociobiology predictions are pretty brutal sometimes. The amazing thing is they come out, and nobody could understand these kinds of behaviors before these ideas became well known. The gene counting procedure that Hamilton Hamilton used, and especially George Williams, 1966 paper, wrote that book on adaptation and natural selection. If you've forgotten who George Williams was, look up back on page 30 where it was described, the impact of his paper, which wasn't immediate because it was not published in the Hamilton paper, but his book had a pretty big impact right away. And it was of major importance to in the period leading up to Wilson's synthesis of that field. Started on this one anyway. Now we're dealing with specific behavior of the damselfly. He has a couple of pictures on it. You remember this one where he shows the females there laying eggs below the surface of the water, and there sits the male that mated with her, and he's watching over her. Isn't he being great? Watches over his female, takes care of her. Question is, why? Why does he stay so near? Why doesn't he just mate with her and fly away and find other females, spread his genes widely? Anybody?
Betty?
Yeah.
Does the pseudo-damselfly might mate again or not?
She might mate again, and the later mating, the sperm from the later mating are likely to be given preference. And they are in that species, so the male that mates and runs away may end up reproducing very little or not at all. You know? So the goal here isn't just to copulate, the goal is to have offspring. And they behave like that's their goal because they practice what Parker called mate guarding. And he won't let other males near. And she sometimes will lay eggs in the water, as you see there in the picture, but she won't lay them all. You know, she could fly up and mate with another male. But wait a minute, wouldn't all her eggs already be fertilized? Not necessarily. Not if she has the ability to store the sperm, decide when she wants to use that sperm. So the males practice mate guarding. Would you expect mate guarding to be common? It was discovered in this little fly. It's amazing. Some of these little obscure animals that these discoveries are made in. And then they find out that the type of behavior occurs again and again and again. You know, in every situation, or in many situations that are similar, you know, because of sperm precedence, the male will guard the female that he's inseminated to increase the likelihood that he will be the father of her offspring. And so we would expect it to be widespread. And it has been found in quite a few different species since that time. Okay, so next time we'll start with this toxic inseminations by fruit flies and try to make sense of some other peculiarities of mating behavior that, again, they weren't thought of before sociobiology. Okay?
The damselfly wouldn't be considered a social insect, right? Or
no, the social insects are the ones that live in these large colonies.
The hymenoptera. Social animals, so that means that animals live in colonies.
Live in large colonies. Those are the social insects. I mean, every animal is social, at least during mating time. The social insects always have workers that don't breed. They're very, very specialized. Like some many ant colonies are like that. That's why most of the animals described in this book are social insects. They live in these large colonies, okay?